Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want. With PayPal, Venmo, Pay Later, and all major cards. So you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loans subject to approval in available locations.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to our first ever show of The Psychology of Success. My name's Paul McVeigh, and some of you may know me from my background in professional football, but I've always been fascinated by this world of mental performance and psychology. And that's the reason why I wanted to start this show, because understanding why people are so successful has always been of real interest to me. Now, today's episode is with Leon Lloyd. Now, Leon has been a former England rugby player, Leicester Tigers, businessman, entrepreneur, keynote speaker, and published author. And Leon has been equally successful in the world of sport and transitioned into the world of business. And listening to what Leon will say should interest everybody, because if you've been that successful, then there must be lessons to learn. So without further ado, let's get into the episode. Hi, everyone, and welcome to our first ever show of The Psychology of Success. My name is Paul McVeigh. And some of you might know my background in professional football, but I suppose I've always had a fascination with mental performance and psychology. And that's why we've started this show today, because I want to interview some, you know, incredibly high performing guests. And I want to understand their psychology of why they've done the things they've done in their careers so that we can all learn from it. So I'm delighted to say that my first guest today has had an incredible career in rugby, business, and is also a published author. So I'm delighted to say and welcome Leon Lloyd to Psychology of Success today. Leon, how are you doing?
I'm very good, thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me on your podcast.
Brilliant, no problem at all. My pleasure, my friend. And listen, I want to get straight into the first question that I'm going to ask all my guests every single time I'm speaking to anybody around the world. And the first question is, what is the definition of success?
Well, if you'd have asked me that, my version of success, but you'd asked me that whilst I was still playing sport, which was a long time ago, it'd be very different to now. I suppose when I played sport, my definition of success was winning and how many titles could we win, how many international caps could you get. But I suppose now everyone has different levels and different versions of success. I suppose it's about understanding what they each are.
And I suppose when you're talking about winning, that in, you know, in my world or in the way that I understand it, is really is performing. It's how do you perform at your best so that you can achieve your desired outcome? And maybe that's possibly even a previous question to what the definition of success is. What is success for you? Because if you aren't sure exactly what your success is or what you're looking to achieve, then obviously that's going to be pretty difficult to go and do that. But whenever you think about performance, what are some of the things that really, for you, especially in the career that you had, and we'll go in and talk about that because I know you're quite interested in talking about your career, but give us some of the reasons why you think you were able to perform at that level for so long.
I think consistency is key for success as well. You know, the old phrase, you know, anyone can win the lottery, but you can't, yeah, it's very unusual to win it twice or three times or four times. Be able to back up that successful experience, be that a win, but then consistently do it again and again and again. I think that's what separates a lot of people. So performance is key, absolutely right. Performance is key to success, certainly from my perspective. But having the ability to back that up, and as you know, my background is team sport. So collectively, can we back that up together as a team over, you know, weeks and weeks and months, and then ultimately over years and seasons and seasons?
So let's just touch on that, Leon. Obviously, you've been very high profile in the world of rugby. You know, started off at Leicester Tigers, and I think it was in 1995, but actually you've had such a long career in rugby, which probably is quite unusual given the physicality of it and the demand and nature of it, the amount of injuries. And I know you've had your fair share of those, but what are some of the things that whenever you were starting your career, you know, as a young lad coming from Coventry, what was that like to suddenly go from that background of inner city Coventry to suddenly walking into a, I suppose it's only can be described as a world-class environment?
Yeah, I don't really know. I think I was naive, and I suppose that helped me, the fact that I was naive and I didn't really know what I was actually walking into. Obviously, I knew what I was walking into, but I didn't really have an understanding of what was expected of me. It's just the game had just turned pro back then when you said. So I was a young 16-year-old who'd just moved over, like you say, into the Coventry to Leicester to see some of these superstars of rugby, you know, the Dean Richards, the Roy Underwoods, the Martin Johnsons, and all those real superstars who I'd watched on TV. And all of a sudden, not only on TV, I'm actually looking at them, and then all of a sudden I'm sat at a dinner table next to them, and then I'm in a changing room getting changed next to them, and then they know my name, and then I'm playing the game with them. It was just surreal, really, to be honest with you. And I suppose, you know, I'm very grateful for that environment that I was put into. You know, I'm a big believer of you're a product of the environment, and being surrounded by so many elite individuals in that you know, at that same time was just great for me as a young kid. I was a sponge. I just lapped it up, and I just literally just listened, didn't speak, just listened and learned from all those great superstars.
But that's interesting, because whenever I had a very similar experience, you know, coming across from Belfast and joining Tottenham Hotspur in 1994, exactly what happened to you. I was surrounded by world-class players, world-class performers. And I sat next to these guys. And the first thing that probably I thought of or that impacted me was my belief, almost my lack of belief in what I could do and almost what I could achieve. But did you have that belief from the start that you were going to be a success?
I didn't really know. So I didn't really, you know, my dream, it's different if you play football to rugby, because rugby was never a career choice. You know, I didn't go to school thinking I want to be a professional rugby player, because it wasn't an option. The game turned pro in 96, so it just coincided with me getting signed. So, you know, I had a career, I had a plan to go into work in the fire service or do something in business, and then play rugby on the side. So it was never really all my eggs in this one basket of playing professional sport, and this is my path going forward. I just felt incredibly lucky that at the age of, I remember 17 when I sort of started getting myself established, and now I got a car. I had a brand new car at 17, and I just felt lucky. And I think that through fear, to be honest, if I look back now, it was fear of having that taken away from me at that young age, and knowing that all of my best mates who I played rugby with in Coventry and all my school friends is able to go back to Coventry and sort of share with them a little bit of what I was experiencing. The fear of having that taken away from me was initially my driver to make sure I didn't cut corners and I put the extra effort in. And then obviously that becomes, you know, part of the process, and you become sort of, you get caught up in the whole environment of that elite mindset, that elite team. And then it stopped being fear of losing it. And then it became about trying to enjoy it. And it's quite difficult to enjoy, you'll know yourself, it's quite difficult to enjoy yourself when you're at that intense level of pressure week in, week out. It's relentless, knowing that, you know, you're not always going to get picked, and you're sort of fighting for your life every week.
And whenever you say that, it does make me think that maybe there was something that you were either thinking the way your mindset was when you were only a 17-year-old young lad. And not everybody gets caught up in it. Not everybody understands the relentless nature of either it's elite sport or working in the business world, where there are so many demands on you. But it seems like you're focused straight away. And interest will probably come back to whether it was fear that was driving you or that desire to succeed. But did you just get swept up in all of that and almost very quickly started performing at that level?
I think as a kid, my dream was to play football. You know, I played, no one in my family played rugby. My dream was to play football and play for the Mighty Sky Blues, Coventry City. you know, and that didn't happen. I played rugby because I was a quick runner. You know, I was always a relatively quick runner. I didn't mind getting into the odd scrap either. You know, as you mentioned before, growing up in inner-city Coventry, you know, fighting was never too far away from you, no matter who you were. But I seemed to find myself into a lot of scrapes. So having that physical edge and also being a quick runner, that sort of merged those two together, sort of points you towards a career in rugby. So I think when I sort of went down that path, I never doubted my ability to run quick. And rugby is a very simple game. And a lot of it is about bravery. And it's about, you know, are you prepared to put your body on the line and do the things that, you know, other people might not do? And if I've got speed in my back pocket as well, and then I've just got to work on my skill set to get better. So I didn't really doubt my ability. I was looking around at the people I was with thinking, oh my goodness, how do I get my skill level up to these guys? And how can I be more dedicated? Because although the game had just turned pro, that team at the time, they were effectively professionals anyway. They had full-time jobs before, but they trained their diet and, you know, their nutrition, their sleep, everything they did was around being an elite full-time professional athlete. So that was alien to me. So I was on a really steep learning curve, and I lived with, I suppose the thing that shaped me the best at the early stages, I got driven over by Neil Back, who, you know, you will know who Neil Back is, but one of the best rugby players England have ever produced, World Cup winner and British Lion. And he used to drive me over from Coventry to Leicester twice a week. So just by being in that car with him and a chap called Pete Lloyd as well, who sort of links us together. He wasn't a relation, but just was from the same junior club as both of us at Barker Burts. Just being involved in that car journey and just listening to the conversations and what was happening with him in his life. And I was just, as I said before, a sponge. And then I got asked if I would consider moving over to Leicester to get me out of the environment that I was in Coventry, move across to Leicester to try and get that mindset and, you know, the diet and the routine and the habit forming. And would I consider living with Martin Johnson? And that in itself was quite a scary, daunting thing. You know, I left home at 16 anyway, but to live with moving to Martin Johnson at 17, and that's not the Martin Johnson we know now, the World Cup winning captain, the Lions captain, the absolute legend. He was still a formidable individual, but to live with him at that such a young age when our backgrounds were so different, I think that definitely put me on the straight and narrow. And I think the club identified that I needed, that I had someone with potential, but I was also someone who had the potential to go a different route. So they wanted someone to put on the straight and narrow, put me on the right track. And I think Jono did that for them and did that for me, which I'm very grateful for.
But that must have been just the steepest of learning curves, because whether it's Martin Johnson after he's won the World Cup with England and captained England, but even before then, he must have already been a top-class performer, a top-class individual. And is it just by osmosis? Was it just by being around him all the time and being in the car with Neil Back that you think you were picking these things up? Because that's all well and good for you, Leon, but how do we learn from those kind of conversations and those kind of experiences that you had?
Yeah, I think there's definitely an element of luck involved. But I try to gravitate towards people who I can learn from, and people, I've always done it even before rugby started. I've always tried to move towards people who I can sort of benefit and learn from. And just by being around them, but we all know famous and successful and, you know, hugely charismatic individuals. But I suppose my mindset was about, you know, I want to aspire to be like those guys. And they'd have training sessions. And bearing in mind, I was an academy player at the time. And they'd go and do a set. And I remember the time they had those Graham Rowntree, Neil Back, Martin Johnson, Darren Grewcock. All these guys were going to do a special elite training session because they were all playing for England. There was little old me, 17-year-old, and John would say, do you want to come to join us? We're going to go and do a track session. Now, all my mates, all my academy teammates were not doing track sessions. They were students and they were doing other things that students do. But I went along and did those extra sessions. And it was a steep learning curve. And I struggled. And I, you know, for a long time, I was at the back of the CV endurance sessions, certainly the physicality side of it. But being exposed to that time after time and making those right choices around food and sleep and making those sacrifices at a young age, that sort of led on to just becoming routine. So when I sort of stopped living with Martin Johnson, they were embedded within me about, you know, you always got a choice, you know. And in my head now, even now, I think about stuff which is nothing to do with sport. I always think, what would Neil Back do? Because, you know, he was somebody who was put up on a pedestal, because his mindset was just, if it's not going to make him a better rugby player or make the team better, then he wouldn't do it. So even now, even if a lot of my things I do now, family, visiting out, I always think, I find myself drifting back thinking, what would Backy do in this situation? And sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't work, because obviously I'm viewing that from a physicality and rugby and training viewpoint. But again, it just goes to show, it's instilled in my mind that we all have this ability to make a decision. Go that way, go left or go right. If I'm going to go right, it means this. If I go left, it could mean this. The decision is ultimately mine. But again, I think that comes from making better decisions consistently, comes from the people that I was surrounded by and that I was very fortunate to be exposed to.
You're listening to the Psychology of Success podcast with Paul McVeigh, sponsored by Moment Digital Limited, live streaming and video producers creating live event content that looks like TV shows, broadcast quality without the cost. Check us out at moment-digital.co.uk.
So, Leon, you're just kind of bringing us up to date with almost like the start of your career, being around world-class people, whether it's Neil Back, whether it's Martin Johnson, that whole array of top-class Leicester Tigers players. So you just mentioned something there, which I think probably is the biggest thing that probably runs through my life, and that's about accountability. So what does accountability mean for you now, as well as how that was shaped through those early days at Leicester Tigers?
Yeah, accountability is huge for me. Then in sport, and again now, everything I do now, you have to be accountable. We all make decisions, we all have decisions and choices, and you stand by them. Win, lose, you know, succeed, fail, you have to stand by your decisions. And you know, people make mistakes, and one of the things that I've developed from sport, again, that environment, is you own your mistakes. You know, you celebrate your wins, yes, absolutely, but if you make a mistake, and sometimes, you know, in elite sport you do those in a high profile, very visible platform, you own them. You know, you don't try and hide and shirk and point fingers. That wasn't accepted in the environment that I was involved in. And I certainly don't accept that now for myself or for my team that I work with now outside of sport. So accountability for me is a crucial, and it's a non-negotiable in the work that I do.
So interestingly, you know, you're talking about taking responsibility for your choices and your actions, and you know, this is you as a young player. Suddenly, you know, not only playing every week for the Tigers, but then getting into the England squad, you know, almost replacing Rory Underwood. And of course, you then make your England debut. Can you give us a little bit of an idea of what happened there?
Yeah, so getting into the Tigers team, as I say, I made my debut at 17. So I suppose the path was set, because if you replace someone like the legend that is Rory Underwood, I think it was the season before, Rory and Tony Underwood, both were playing for Leicester and for England. The Wafford Road, the Tigers ground, opened up a restaurant called the Underwood Suite. So the fact that they've got this room named after them, and this young skinny kid from Coventry that no one had heard of had just replaced this absolute Leicester and English and British Lions legend, that was tough, you know. So I wasn't everyone's cup of tea initially, because, you know, who am I to replace that guy? So the pressure was on straight away. And then to sort of go through that and try and battle week in, week out, trying to get my space in the team, and then we had a new coach, and I remember the game turned pro. So everyone was trying to find their feet. And I was very fortunate to have played England schoolboys, and then played England 21s, England Colts, England all the way through, England A. And then I got my chance to, after a decent season for Leicester, when we won quite a lot of trophies, there was a purple patch we went through where we won the league, we won the Hunting Cup a couple of times, won a domestic cup. And my team, I say my team, it wasn't my team, but the Tigers team, were very dominant in England and in Europe. So I think we must have made up, you know, a third, nearly half of the English squad at the time was made up of Leicester players. So it wasn't like going into an England team where you're one player from one of the 12 different clubs. Straight away, it was a lot easier for me, because 10 of the guys in that side were my teammates. So I already knew most of the guys there, and I'd played against everybody else anyway. So that environment was definitely a step up for anything that I'd experienced before, but it certainly helped for the fact that the guys who I went up there with, well, had been there a long time, established, and you know, it was easy for me to sort of fit in with those guys and sort of find my feet a lot quicker than it would be normally.
And so, again, getting on to England, and again, you sort of mentioned about you love the physicality of rugby, which is obviously the complete opposite of what I did on a football pitch, because if anyone came near me, I'd normally run 50 yards. But being 4 foot nothing versus you're 6 foot four, so slight difference maybe in physicality. But when it came to that debut, England, tell us what happened with the Springbok.
I know where you're going with this, Mr. McVeigh. So I, as I mentioned before, you know, I what I lacked in skill, I certainly made up for an aggression in my style of play. I think exactly how I describe myself, I was relatively quick. What I lacked in skill, I made up for an aggression. And I'm not a dirty player. And my record would show that as well. I think I've only had 2 yellow cards out my whole career. But there was definitely a perception that I played on the edge, and I wanted that. And that's how I played. I needed to feel like I was pushing myself. And my debut against South Africa, we played against obviously South Africa away at Loftus-Versfeld altitude, and I was on the bench. I think it was Mike Tyndall and Mike Catt were playing, and I kept getting ready to come on. One of those guys are going down injured, and I get the tracksuit off, get ready to go on, and it just seemed like it wasn't happening because they kept getting back up again. And I went on with about 15, 20 minutes to go. Really tight game. You know, England never beaten South Africa away in South Africa on a normal test series. And to go on that, and to go on with 15 minutes to go, 15, 20 minutes to go, it was such a close game. We just had a try disallowed by Tim Stimpson. And I remember running on and seeing all these, all my teammates, my Leicester teammates, as I ran on. And I just remember thinking, I think it was Jono said, get your hands on the ball, get stuck in straight away. And I literally did that. I ran on, and all those dreams, you're an international football player. You dream of playing for your country, right? And when it happens, you don't have time to think about, I've done it. I've actually achieved that thing that everyone told me that, you're never going to reach that pinnacle. There's so many hurdles you're going to have to get through, injuries and everything else. When you actually run on, it was like a blur for me. I ran on, it was just like a weird scenario. And I got my hands on the ball early on in that game, and I went in and hit my first rock, bang. And yes, they weren't lying when they said it's a step of intensity and aggression and physicality. And I got absolutely smashed. I've got a scar on my chin because I got kicked in the face. And that's not nothing new. People get kicked in the face in rugby. That's just sort of part and parcel. And I retaliated as anyone from Coventry would for getting kicked in the face. And I sort of just retaliated and just threw a quick right jab and carried on with the game going through. And then the ref blew his whistle. And I thought, and at the time I thought, I could taste blood in my mouth and I could see blood coming out my chin. And as he blew his whistle, I looked up on the screen, the big screen in the corner of the ground, and it showed in slow motion me leaning over this poor South African Springbok player on his back, and just shows me punching him in the face in slow motion with blood and spit and everything going everywhere. And I looked like some savage animal attacking this poor defenseless player. And the reality hit straight away that, oh my God, rewind it a little bit, show that he kicked me in the face first, at least show that bit. But they didn't, they just showed that. And I'd just come onto the field, as I said just before, and the referee calls me over with our captain. He reaches his hand in his pocket, and I think he's going to send me off. And my heart just literally stopped. And he came over, and I think he realised I'd just come onto the field, and he sort of pulled his hand out and said, any more of that from you and you're off. And the relief that I didn't get sent off was just unbelievable. The reality is that I gave away a penalty. They came up, Brian Strong came up, kicked that penalty. We ended up losing the match on that penalty kick. It was such a close game, and I'd given away a penalty, and there was still time for me to change the outcome of that game, but we couldn't as a team. We ended up losing that match. So for me to go from that ultimate high of representing my country, making my debut, all those things making my family proud and everything else, that devastating low of feeling like I let myself down, my family down, you can see my voice is going a bit now, my team down. But also when you play at that level, you're letting your country down. That's just huge. That is just massive. And to the point that I've never watched that debut, that match back ever since that time. Just going to show it's sort of a defining point in my, not in my career, but in my life. That was a real low point for me. And thankfully, I got picked again. We managed to play South Africa the following week, and we won. The coach stuck by me because it would have been very easy for the Clive Woodward to not have picked me for the following week. And that could have been the end of it. But he did pick me, and I came off the bench again, but managed to hold on for the win, which was great for me. But still, that one game, that one match, that one moment in time certainly defined a lot of, shaped my path to who I am now.
No, and it sounds like it's the almost the best thing that ever happened, coming on to represent your country, and the worst thing that ever happened. Then it probably goes back into that whole subject that we discussed earlier of accountability and taking responsibility for your actions, because there is nothing you can do. You have got to take that fact that it's on you. They've lost the game because of what you've done. But that actually is really interesting, because what I want to know, it's not necessarily the fact that that happened, but how did that shape you going forward?
Well, I know, like resilience is a buzzword that people use a lot now in all walks of life. So I think now when I go through a tough time, how I felt, knowing that the headlines said Lloyd cost England Test match, those things there which will never go away. No matter how bad a day I'm having at the office or anything else, I can think back to that and think, God, it wasn't as bad as that. You know, when you do something on that scale, so I think the ability to reframe things, and I ended up writing a book around, as you mentioned at the beginning in the intro, about I'm an author, so I wrote a book about from bootroom to boardroom, and it's not about how good I thought I was or how fortunate I was to win, you know, many trophies and represent my country and score tries and things like that. It's more about the lessons I would tell a younger version of myself, and what would I do differently, the ultimate highs, the devastating lows, and all those bits in between. And I suppose if I hadn't have made that I'm not for 1 minute saying I'm glad I came off the bench, give away a penalty and cost my team and their country that match, but if I hadn't have done that, then I probably wouldn't have written a book about how do you reframe really dark moments, and how I've gone down this path of talking about leadership, success and resilience and all those things now, because, you know, it shapes the direction you go in. So in a way, what I've been able to do is reframe that horrendous period in my life. And it's the end of the, I know you can people say it's just sport. No one died. It's just sport. But if that's what you're wrapped up in, that's the only thing that meant that was the most important thing to me in my life at that time. That's a big thing. So to be able to reframe that and be able to take positives from it and then help other people learn from it, I think that I've managed to reframe that and turn it into a positive outcome as best as I possibly can.
And that whole word of reframe is quite interesting, because I think a lot of people might have heard of that word in terms of reframe, or if you haven't, it's just simply think about a situation in a different way. And you're saying that you did reframe it, but what other way is there to think about you costing the country the match, you kind of almost, you know, for a better phrase, messing up on your debut? How can you reframe that?
Well, I suppose it was definitely out of character. The challenge I had was, because I had this reputation of playing the game on the edge, people assume that that's what I did all the time. And it's like, oh, of course he did that, because that's who he is, that's what he does. And it was a point for me that I had to try and prove to other people, I didn't need to prove anything to myself, because I knew that was how I played the game. And as I say, I won't keep pointing back to it, but I never got red carded. I never got yellow cards. I got involved in scraps and scuffles, but all part of the game. There's an element of me then for the next couple of years of trying to prove to the public, the fans, the supporters, the media, that that was a one-off incident. My teammates knew it was a one-off incident. I didn't want to be judged by that one-off incident. And I'm sure most of the people now, I say this with fingers crossed, most of my teammates now who remember back to that game probably have forgotten the reason we lost. You know, it's so long ago and it's probably been covered over with different wins that they've had. But for me, because it meant it was so personal to me, I won't forget it. And I won't make that mistake again. And being accountable is, you know, you make a mistake, you can't make that same mistake twice. So I suppose for me, how do you reframe it? I think it's, yeah, I'm never going to be put in that situation where I can make that mistake again. But it's about having that pressing that pause button, and before I react to something, thinking about the consequences, I suppose, is the best way I could reframe that.
Yeah, and I suppose that's really, we all have that option of whatever's happening in our lives, whether it's professional lives, personal lives, things, you know, many times don't turn out how they want or how we might want them to
rarely.
Go. I suppose having that ability to reframe it. Rarely, absolutely, because I suppose whatever we're deciding to work towards, and that probably just leads into the fact that this whole show and this whole series is all called The Psychology of Success. But in reality, failure is an option, and I suppose the question, or a better question, is should we be encouraged to fail?
Yeah, see, I'm not one for encouraging failure. I definitely buy into the fact that some of my biggest lessons have come from losses. You know, I'm very fortunate to have played for a very dominant side. We won 11 major trophies. We were the champions of Europe back to back, two consecutive years. We had something like a 5-year, 6-year unbeaten home record. So we dominated a period of time, which was amazing. During that period of domination, we also lost in 5 finals. So, you know, if you add those up, that's 16 opportunities to be the best. We lost in 5 finals on the big stage. Two of those were Hiding Cups, so the European Cups. And those losses, I can feel those losses today. I can't remember the wins were great and they're amazing. I remember the experience building up to it, the team, the culture, and everything else. And But those losses, and how did we turn those losses around to make sure we learned from those going forward? You know, I'd be lying to you if I said, I'd love to be sat here now talking to you, talking about, you know, I had an amazing career, you know, 100 caps for him and 16 major wins for Leicester. But the reality is, you know, I have this sweet and sour analogy, which is to fully appreciate the sweet, you have first have got to have tasted the sour. Now, I've tasted in sport, we all taste moments of sour, but in sport, losing in finals, especially when you're the favourite and you're expected to win, that is a sour taste. So if I hadn't have lost in those finals with my team, then we wouldn't have been able to, you know, be so elated when we won those other finals after them, because you've got to go to those dark places and feel that pain, that sour, to be able to fully appreciate the sweet at the top end of the spectrum. So I'm a big believer of, again, it comes to reframing. You know, if something bad happens, I think, right, that means that when something good happens, I'm going to take that bad, multiply it by 100, then the good is going to be tasted even sweeter. But again, I don't know if that's sport, I don't know if that's success, I don't know if that's psychology, but that's just how I personally view things. That's the lens I look through.
Today's podcast is sponsored by CSS Investments, a London-based regulated stockbroker that offers a bespoke advisory investment service for stocks and shares. I've personally used CSS for over 5 years now and happily recommend their services. You can find out more at css-investments.com. Please do remember that, as with all investing, your capital is at risk.
I really want to pick your brains on leadership and being around leaders and what makes a great leader, and maybe some of the people you've been around that haven't maybe been the best leaders. So can you give us some insight into whether it's Martin Johnson, Clive Woodward, Neil Backer, or even just what you were doing to lead yourself through your, not just your sporting days, but what you've done since then?
Yeah, so without doubt, the best captain, the best leader I've been fortunate to play with, Martin Johnson. His record speaks for itself, so I'm not going to spend any time talking him up. He gets enough plaudits and fully deserved. But I suppose the good thing about that team that I played in under Jono, and also if you look at the England team that he captained and led on to victory, and the Lions team that he captained that led on to victory, is underneath his, every team as a captain, underneath that one captain, there are a series of mini leaders. It wasn't just Martin Johnson captained and that's why we win, because we had lots of other leaders. We had, you know, we had at Leicester, you know, Neil Back was a leader. Darren Garforth was a scrum leader. Graham Rowntree, Austin Healey, you know, in the back. So I led the defence. We had leaders all throughout, and we had world-class players all throughout. It wasn't all put upon Martin Johnson's shoulders. We used to joke about it, because Jono's job really was to flick the coin at the start of the game to decide whether he ran out, ran left, ran right. The rest of it was down to us, because we all had our jobs, and it comes back to that accountability piece. So we were so accountable that when we had our video analysis sessions following the weekend, we didn't need somebody else to point out to us, oh, Lloydy, you dropped a ball there, or you missed a tackle there, you did that and the other, because we knew, we owned it, we stood up, we'd actually come out and we said, I tried to do this, it didn't work, this is what I was trying to do, would I do it again? And you sort of go through those. We had these proper open, this forum where we were open and able to not criticize, but check and challenge each other, whether you were Jono and you had, you know, 80 odd caps or whatever we got, or whether you were a young academy player just coming through making your debut. You know, respectfully, you had the platform there to be able to say, you know, I disagree, or I think I'll do this, or not. You know, I made a mistake here. But, you know, if I had the same opportunity again, I would do the same thing again. And then that would allow somebody else to come back and say, well, why would you? That's wrong. But they're having that freedom and that flexibility to be able to talk openly in that, on that platform. That didn't come. That wasn't there when I first joined Leicester. When I first joined Leicester, it was that very old school, the amateur era of, you know, you needed to play 50 games before you were allowed to talk to anybody. You know, that's what it was when I first joined. And then when this new influx of players come through, the Lewis Moodies, the Paul Gustard, the Andy Goo, the Jordan Murphys, you know, these players that came through, there was a new breed, the game turned professional, the coaches empowered. The younger voices to come through in a very respectful way. That's the key word there, is respectful. Respectful accountability. And that sort of breeds, you know, that winning culture, that professionalism. And before you know it, you know, those who don't swim in that direction stand out like a sore thumb. And if you're in an elite environment, you don't stay in that elite environment if you don't buy into those team values, that culture. And we had some amazing world-class people, world-class individual players that joined. That squad didn't fit into that culture, and then they went off and became, or continued to be, world-class players elsewhere. And that's fine. but there were some non-negotiables in that environment. And it wasn't John. People on the outside might look and think that's Martin Johnson with his big finger and his frown, just shouting at people, giving out bollockings all the time. It wasn't that at all. You know, we held ourselves to account. We were very peer-led. Our director of rugby, you know, the boss was Dean Richards, who was a very uncompromising character. John Wells, assistant coach, a very hard man, both ex-policemen. But very rarely did they need to dish out bollockings to people because we did it ourselves. We could look someone in the eye and just say that wasn't good enough. And most of the time, you wouldn't need to say that because the person would say, lads, you know, I messed up there, that wasn't good enough. And that, I think when you get that environment, it's amazing. One of my biggest regrets is not realizing that at the time, because I was lucky to be in that environment, I thought that was normal. I thought that's what happens everywhere. It's only when you step outside of that environment, you go to somewhere else, you look back and think, wow, you know, we did that and that was just normal practice. Whereas everyone will be high-fiving because someone's owned up to a mistake. We're like, of course he owned up to a mistake. It's his mistake. You should own it. But again, you take those things for granted if you're in those elite environments.
I think that's really interesting. No, it does. And I think what you're probably talking about is what, you know, elite performance, what leadership, what, you know, a top class, world class team environment is like. And you know, Leon, both of us working in the corporate world today, you know, for the last 10 years or so, since we both stopped professional sport. And I think that's why there's probably so much crossover, because of the amount of teams that are being led by certain individuals or leadership teams. And they're always trying to improve what they do. How do they do it? What are some of the characteristics or some of the traits or behaviors that, like a world-class team that you had at the time, you know, what can that be taught across to the business world? But I think what's interesting is I've always thought that leadership was, whether it's a Martin Johnson, Clive Wood, whoever it is, you know, this individual who's performing at a certain level and almost dragging people with them. But maybe slightly different way to look at it is more, it's almost a process where you have possibly someone in charge, but they can only lead if you have this group or following that want to go where they're going to.
Yeah, absolutely. I think back to my first proper job when I finished sport. I retired at 30, you know, and I failed, you know, as a leader, I failed because I'd come from an environment where I knew it was successful because I, you know, lots of trophies to show that it was successful. But I was exposed to a certain type of leadership style. And my personality traits, and, you know, I do all the psychometrics and behavioral profiles and everything else. I'm a very red, I'm very sort of competitive. And I suppose if you play that level of sport, that sort of drive, that brings that out in me as an individual. And I've got proven knowledge and history that shows that that particular type of leadership works and achieves results. What I didn't understand was, outside of that elite sporting environment and in the, you know, the non-sport environment, if you like, that didn't work for everybody. Everyone's different. And I failed because I had an executive assistant to become the best executive assistant that they could possibly be, that they could then become my bosses, you know, my line manager, executive assistant. So that was the career path. And my job was to make them better. Because if they're better, that means I'm going to be better. That's a whole team mentality. If they're really good at their job, the best they can be, then that's going to make the team look good. And I'm the leader of that team, so I'm going to be good. We're all going to benefit from it. What I realized was that they didn't want that. They didn't want that career progression. And I was never involved in an environment where someone didn't want to be the best they could be, where it was actually a job, you know, not a career. So when it comes to 5 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, down tools, don't disturb me until Monday. And I really struggled mentally with the fact that they wouldn't go and do the extra, do a bit more. How can I be better? How can I help somebody else in my team? So I failed at that. I suppose that's what led me down this path of exploring leadership. And I went on to do my undergraduate degree in leadership and management. Now, I left school at 16 to sign pro, as I mentioned. But to understand, I sort of baffled and I was struggling to understand how this certain style of leadership, which I'd seen be so successful, was really failing. And it made me look at myself and think, well, is it me? And I kept thinking, it can't be me because I know it works. But what I did realize after by going away and studying it was there are lots of different ways and situational leadership comes in and each person's different. And you know, your parents would say to you, you know, treat people as you want to be treated yourself. That was a mistake. It's about treating people how they want to be treated. And I think from a leadership perspective, not understanding that as an individual, but learning to understand that to get the best out of somebody else, I need to treat them how they want to be treated rather than how I prefer to be treated, is the best way of getting to achieving that collective goal.
But then I suppose that's the interesting part, isn't it? Because the collective goal might not have been set or, I don't know, discussed with the entire team. Because a lot of times in the corporate world, you have almost a target that is just forced upon you. So if you're part of that team, you know, have you had any experiences where the people within that team don't really want to hit that target for the big bosses?
Absolutely, yeah. So I think that's a key part about understanding your team and your team members. And as a leader, you need to understand what motivates each individual. Now, some of those motivations might be around money. Some of them might be around success and status. You know, so it's understanding what their personal drivers are and embedding that within the team ethos, the team culture, so that I know how to get the best out of this person. And that's because they want recognition. It's not about financial, you know, they don't want financial reward. It's about recognition. So making sure for them to strive, what does their path look like, that they can hit those milestones and get recognized for those milestones, versus somebody who's not really cared about, doesn't really care about recognition. They're motivated by money. So it's about how do you define a pathway so the person who cares about recognition, the person who cares about money, or a person who cares about just achieving the overall goal, they've all got their own different journeys. And they all combine together so that they're able to collectively, the team, we achieve that success. If you think everyone's the same as you and they all want to make the organization the best, they might not be, you know, invested in that organization for the same reason. So I think taking that time to understand individuals is crucial. You know, in a way, it's a little bit easier in sport, because why do you play professional sport? It's to win at the weekend. Ultimately, that's why you play. You want to get better. You want to be the best you can be. At the end of the day, you play because you want to win. You want to achieve things. You want to represent your country. You want to do climb that ladder. Outside of sport, you know, that's not always the case. So it's understanding what the personal and motivational drivers are for each individual, but then having a plan and a strategy in place that can combine all those good people, those great people, to achieve the collective goal.
Yeah, and that's why whenever I am speaking to, whether it's, you know, a director, whether it's an MD, whoever it happens to be within the organization, and they do want certain things to be achieved, but actually, the people within the organization don't always necessarily want to get it to the level that maybe the leaders want to get it to. And like you're talking about, it's probably comes down to influencing and maybe influencing behaviors. And that's why this whole world of psychology and mental performance just fascinates me, because if you want to influence somebody, well, instead of just telling them what to do, that is one way of influencing them, but might not last very long. But actually influencing their mindset or their mentality, for me, has always been the best starting point.
Yeah, absolutely. That's like transformational leadership. Understanding the individual, you'll be able to understand their motives and their triggers and the things that actually get them to go above and beyond. You know, I talk a lot about, you know, I'm fortunate to go and work in a lot of, you know, big businesses, large big organizations. And I talk a lot about the psychological contract, about what do you do in addition to what your job description says. You know, when it says 9 to 5, why do those people that really succeed and go on to achieve more do more after 5 o'clock? They don't, you know, your job doesn't stop at 5 o'clock. It's understanding that those people who, I think it was Eddie Jones or somebody I read in a newspaper that said, you know, the good people do the things correct from 9 to 5, but the great ones do the good things from 5 back until 9 in the morning. So they're doing it all day. So they're always thinking about how they can be better, how can they improve. And I suppose it's understanding, I go back and I'm sort of repeating myself a little bit, but saying what motivates me as an individual. So I'd expect my line manager or my captain to say, well, okay, we've got Leon here. What drives him? What are his motivations in life? You know, at work, also outside of work, you know, that work-life balance. And how can I make him feel that he can go above and beyond what we're expecting of him? Because that's when the magic stuff happens. You know, we can all do the job that's written down for us and he's sort of being told what to do. That's a bit more transactional, I suppose. But when the creative stuff happens and people go above and beyond, you get those little bits of gold dust. And, you know, I'm speaking from experience of when we achieve those successes, because we did went above and beyond what was expected of us. And that's when you get one or two people doing that, it's great. You get 4, 5, 6 people doing that, you know, you can change some serious, make some serious gain.
The Psychology of Success podcast is brought to you by Moment Digital Limited, live streaming and multi-camera video producers with over 30 years' experience in broadcast TV. Check us out at moment-digital.co.uk.
Now, Leon, this is interesting because I know one of your huge passions in life is all around transition. And it's not just when you come out of a sport or a career in elite sport of coming from that into getting maybe a normal job, as you might call it, or I might call it. But it's not just the transition out of sport into a normal 9-to-5. What's the other kind of transitions do we have in life? And also, why are you so passionate about this area?
I think we're always transitioning, whether you're going from junior school to senior school, from senior school to university, from university to your first job, academy squad to senior squad, being single to in a relationship to being single again. We're always transitioning all the time. And understanding those transitions, planning for them and understanding that they're going to happen, it can give you the head start and make sure you can have an effective transition. One of the things that I'm really passionate about is transitioning to something rather than transitioning away from something. And I say that based on my sporting experience. When I retired at the age of 30, I started at 16, 17, then I finished at 30, which is a long career, but I could have played longer. I could have gone on for another 3 or 4 years if it hadn't been for injury. But having that period where I was lost and I was so wrapped up in that identity of being an athlete, and even though I knew it was going to happen, not having something else to transition to, and I kept focusing on transitioning it away from sport. And that's the anchor that holds you back. So I try, again, it's reframing. I go back to looking at things, be passionate about, be enthusiastic about transitioning towards something and using it as a launch pad to get to where you want to get to, as opposed to, transitioning away from something and sort of having that anchor. And it's a comfort zone, isn't it? You always go back to what's comfort, comforting for us. So that's why a lot of people, when they retire from something, they keep pushing themselves. And when they have that first failure or they can't maintain that, they go back the next level of where they were successful and they stay there, that's their area of comfort. And I'm really passionate about pushing people to strive outside their comfort zone, but also planning. Plan, there's a phrase, plan your panic. Know when things are happening, they're going to happen, put things in place so that you can cope and you can accommodate that, so it doesn't stop you, you don't fall off the edge of a cliff. It's coming, you plan for it, you can go forward. And I think transitioning is huge. There are some things you can't plan for, obviously, like the pandemic and black swan scenarios. But again, having the ability to reframe and be accountable, controlling the controllables, all these little phrases which I live my life by, help you get through those really tough times. And I think for me, having come through some tough times for my own transition, I like to help other people prepare for theirs and learn from each other. Because I'm sure there are more tough times ahead for me and for other people as well. But by putting things in place to make those less tough, then that'll be that sort of gives you that feeling of achievement.
And one of the things that I'd promise everyone who was going to join us over this journey over the next few months on the psychology of success is just by listening to people like yourself that we can all learn from this, and you don't have to have had an elite sporting background to come and learn from that, because you say people are transitioning all the time, whether it's from one job to another job, one relationship to another, from one country to another. So hopefully, like you said, these are some of the things you live by and probably why you've been so successful, because to have the sport and career, but then how few people go on and have a career after elite sport. And you have been a CEO, you've been a keynote speaker, you're an author. We have obviously started bespoke elite speaker training. So do you want to just touch on that for a minute? Because I know we've only got a few minutes left. I only want to spend a little bit of time on it, but just talk us through a little bit of why you wanted to get involved in this world of training people to become keynote speakers.
Yeah, so I didn't really know what a keynote speaker was when I was playing sport. I didn't really know. I've done afternoon speaking, and I've done Q&As and things like that. And then I've sort of, when I wrote my book around, from bootroom to boardroom, transitioning around that, the key area for me that I was passionate about was culture, teamwork, success, which we've talked about today, leadership, resilience, all those things which I picked up through sport. And then I was asked to go and speak at different organizations talking about those topics. And I think when we met, Paul, we met on a program, a corporate governance program, which is probably the least sexiest program you can think of going on to go. But I think it's just both of our, you know, our desires to just get better and improve ourselves, and went on that course. And, you know, I realized that you were doing keynote speaking, and I was really, your area is different to mine, as this podcast alludes to, being around psychology and success. Mine's around, as I said before, the culture side. Everyone's got a story to tell. Everyone has got more than one story to tell. And I learned so much from listening to TED Talks, listening to other people speak, books I read, podcasts I listen to. I'm always out there trying to listen. And some of the key learnings I pick up from people are the people that I've never even, you know, heard of before, and no one's heard of. So I think what we do through that speaker program is help people, give them a voice that they can speak anyway. Again, they've done their Q&As and other things, but give them the confidence to share their story and make it so it's relatable to other people. That's the thing. I think we hear lots of stories from people, and you can't, sometimes it's just a story. It's a nice story to listen to. And you go away and you think, well, that was a great story, but how can I relate to that? How can I relate to climbing Everest? How can I relate to winning 5 Olympic medals or something like that? When you can flip it on its head and let me, the listener, go away and change something in my life based on what you've said to me, then it's powerful. And I think that's when it becomes tangible. And I think when you can see people and help people do that, that's great. I love doing that myself, and hopefully I can impart some little bits of knowledge that I've picked up. But also I love it when I can see other people go away and think, right, they didn't realize that was a key learning part of their journey. But now, in a room full of 200 people, half of them are going to go away and going to go and do that. And I think that's the power of keynote speaking. That's why I love it. And I think that's why we sort of align together to sort of set up bespoke elite speaker training.
And I know that you say it's one of the closest feelings or closest experiences you have to walking out at Twickenham, or, you know, just crossing that white line onto the rugby field of going up, stand up on stage and deliver your keynote. And yeah, absolutely. It is still a massive buzz, which is why I kind of spend 100% of my time doing it. But I suppose what I wanted to understand from you is, where do you think is, why can someone who's won a World Cup talk equally as expertly as someone who's maybe just had a background where they've not been an elite performer, they've not started a multi-million pound business, they haven't climbed Everest? Why can those two compete on the same stage?
For me, that's quite simple, although it may not seem simple when you look at it initially. Because we've all experienced, I've not won a World Cup yet. I still hold out. I don't know how. We've all got a World Cup moment in us somewhere. We've got a World Cup moment in us. So to be able to relate to what, you know, 7 of my Leicester Tigers teammates won a World Cup, I can't relate to that feeling of winning that World Cup. It must have been amazing. But so if that's the pinnacle for them, achieving something really great for them that they've worked really hard to achieve, a 4-year program where things need to fall in place for you to achieve that, every single person in the world has a plan to achieve something, and it may be in a period of time. So whilst it might not be to win, to go out and lift up the Webb Ellis Trophy, it might be to a promotion, or it might be to, you know, buy a house, or it might be to change jobs. It might be something completely different. But we've all got that plan, and to be able to relate to the things that that World Cup winning team, or that explorer that went to the North Pole, the strategy, the sacrifice, the dedication, the attention to detail, all those steps they went through to achieve that. We as mere mortals that didn't win a World Cup, who have not gone to the North Pole, can relate to that by having a plan. What do I need to do to achieve the first step, then the second step, then the third step, and ultimately you get to that point. I think the power that storytelling has within that is really, really crucial to enabling all of us to be able to take learnings from the superstars that achieve those extraordinary things, because we can all achieve them. We just need to have a plan and put things in place and just take learnings from all the things that we can experience.
And even the one of the things that really stands out for me over, you know, speaking to so many high performing individuals, and even people who've, you know, not necessarily had the same kind of CV or career, but the one common trait that seems to, I don't know, run rife through people who've never stood up on stage and delivered a keynote, is their just lack of belief that they think they can do it, when probably I would say, and hopefully you agree with this, that anyone can do it.
Yeah, there is one of the fears, isn't it? One of the big fears in life, public speaking. It is about confidence. It's about having that belief that you've actually got something, not just something worthwhile to say, but have I got the ability to say it in a way that it can empower, impart knowledge on somebody else. And yeah, I think it's confidence. Yeah, you're right. It's belief. I think that's the key word. Everyone can do it. It does take a bit of time, a bit of practice, but confidence is key. But I suppose that the main thing is understanding you have got some. We've all got something to share, at least one, two, or three things that we can share with other people. It's about putting the things in place to enable us, to give us the best chance of succeeding and sharing those stories.
Yeah, absolutely. So listen, I want to move on from the speaker training and just a couple of last questions, Leon, just to bring this fascinating conversation to a close. What has been the price of your success?
Wow. The price. I think I sacrificed a lot as a player, and no different to anybody else, I'm sure, of my team, because I knew what I wanted. I wanted to be the best player. You think, I want to be the best player in the world. And when you realize you're not going to be the best player in the world, you want to be the best player you can possibly be. I want to be the best version of myself. And I sacrificed relationships and, you know, nights out, all those things that for a normal young teenager or young 20-year-old would be able to go out and enjoy. I sacrificed those things to be able to achieve the things I did as a professional athlete. Now, I don't look back with any regrets at all. If I had my time again, I would absolutely sacrifice the exact same thing, because that was the balance. That, you know, just to achieve this, I need to give away that. The decision point that we talked about before, you know, you need to be accountable for your decision, your action. So I wouldn't change too much, even that dreaded England debut. I wouldn't change that, because I think it shapes who you are. And I think you've got to make the best of the scenarios that you find yourself in. So success comes in lots of different shapes and sizes. So I wouldn't change anything. I don't know if I've sacrificed too much. Everything I have sacrificed has been a conscious decision. And as I say, I feel very fortunate to have achieved what I've achieved to date, but hopefully there's a few more successes in me. So again, I know there are a lot more sacrifices to come as well to achieve. If I want to achieve them and be the absolute best I can be and win my World Cup outside of playing, then I've got more sacrifices to make. So they'll all be worth it.
Well, hope you win that World Cup one day. Well, what do they say to put your second best question up first, and your last question is your best? So hopefully this is it. What is your definition of success today?
Today's been good because it's had me reflect back on lots of things which I've not talked about for a while. For me, success is setting yourself a goal, achieving your goal without, this is me speaking personally, achieving my goal without sacrificing my morals and my values. I think that would be, for me, success. It's not always about winning and losing, because you're going to lose little bits along the way, but the ultimate goal is, how do I get there without sacrificing or challenging my own morals and my values? That's really important to me to get there.
Wow, brilliant. Leon Lloyd, thank you very much for your time today, for your honesty, sharing all those highs and lows. It's been a real pleasure, and probably something we haven't spoken about as much over the last few months, but really, really appreciate it. And thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Well, what a great first episode of The Psychology of Success. Listening to Leon talking about his journey and all of the highs, incredible successes as a professional sportsman, and plenty of lows, but listening how he dealt with them, hopefully, if you're anything like me, there were so many lessons to take away. How he reframed some of the most difficult situations that he's been in, the mantras that he surrounds himself with constantly. What did Neil Back do? What would he do in this scenario? Even when he's retired and not has anything to do with elite sport, he's still thinking about that accountability and how to be world-class in whatever he does. So I hope you enjoyed the first episode with Leon Lloyd of The Psychology of Success. And we will be back next time with Olympic gold medalist Chris Akabusi. And hopefully you can join us then.
This podcast has been produced by Neil Stainsby and Peter Wright of Moment Digital Limited. Hayley Brasnett is the editor. And thanks again to Emily Drake for all of our social media marketing. on the Psychology of Success.
Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want. With PayPal, Venmo, Pay Later, and all major cards. So you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loans subject to approval in available locations.